Chapter 15. Shrine. Songs of fear, dreams of war. My father's side. Comet Shrine, Inner System Gulf. The comet was not undefended. 8 gun platforms ringed it, tracking its flight through the heavens with batteries of turbo lasers and rockets. Their all-specs and targeting systems had enough power to see far beyond the reach of their guns. Once they detected and locked onto a target, they could coordinate fire with enough precision to equal the kill output of a starfort. It was enough that anything less than multiple battleships would be ill-advised to approach uninvited. The servitors wired into the weapon platform's all-specs twitched in their cradles. Somewhere, out on the edge of their machine sight, something was moving. Something large. All weapon batteries cycled to ready. Vox signals flickered between each gun platform. The servitors looked deeper, focusing all their systems on the approaching ship. None of them noticed the frost forming on their skin and wiring. Fingers of thought brushed their lobotomized minds, pulling them deeper into their focus, drawing their sight away from everything that was not that distant glimmer of a ship getting nearer. They did not see the gunships sliding towards them out of the dark. Unmarked by engine heat, the small craft had begun their flight beyond the limit of the platform's sight. Minds inside the gunships reached out, focusing down and down into the root meat of the servitors' minds. The gunship's engines fired. The servitor-governed systems saw nothing. They were still seeing nothing as missiles blew holes in the skin of each platform. Now alarms did begin to sound. Weapon servitors jerked to life, but too late. Crimson-armored warriors were already inside the corridors. Waves of telekinesis blew in bulkheads, and bolter fire shredded servitors and systems. The gun platforms were silent as the lone ship closing on the comet became 12. Ahriman did not watch any of the last stages of the assault play out. In the dark of his gunship as it burned towards its target, he focused his mind on the growing patterns surrounding it in the ether. He had been preparing, body, mind, and spirit, for days, locking patterns of thought and symbolism into his subconscious. The roots of the Colchisian symbol sets and the word-bearer's pseudo-occult rites had required a great deal of refinement and integration into the Prosperine system. It was like trying to mix oil and water, or gold and iron slag. He had done it, though. Few others could have, he fancied. "There is a failsafe in the Comet Shrine itself," came Ignis's thought voice, cutting into Ahriman's reflections. "A detection system slaved to a series of kill charges."
"Disable it," replied Ahriman.
"That is in progress, but the detection system also has an etheric monitor grafted to its core. Our remote viewing of the outer halls almost triggered it. I have sent in Credence to remove the detection system's core." Ahriman thought of the automaton that now followed the Master of Ruin like a looming shadow. "It is a machine, brother. To give it a name is to try to call a soul into something that has neither the spirit nor the will to make choices."
Silence fell between their minds.
Around Ahriman, the minds of his brothers whirled on, patterning the ether with their thoughts. Each of them was looping a set of symbols and words through his subconscious. Those of greater power and ability spun more complex weaves of thought, all overlapping and meshing with one another. Together, their minds were like the cogs of a single colossal machine. At the pattern's core was Ahriman, subsections of his own thoughts meshing with those of his brothers. This feat alone was beyond the bounds of comprehension of even the most able of adepts, but it was only the beginning, one part of the key to turn a greater lock. It had taken days for Ahriman to comprehend the details of what they were doing, and then he had shivered. Even Magnus had fallen silent when it had been laid before them. For this thing that they were doing was not their design. It was something higher and darker and greater, the design of a creature who had never been human, and now stood between mortality and godhood. It was Horus's act, and they were the tools that did his work.
Why do we do this? He had asked Magnus the Red.
You know why, my son, Magnus had replied. Because everything we want, everything we need, lies beyond the fall of my father.
Ahriman had nodded, but not tried to hide the doubt in his mind. The image of Magnus in the scrying mirror had given a sad smile.
Besides, Azek, do you not wish to see the towers of Leth again? Or to walk the scribe vaults? Do you not wish to go home?
They burned our home. The image had shimmered in the haze of cedar smoke.
To all of humanity, terror is home. That is why it must fall, my son.
The detection and trigger device has been disabled on the comet, came Ignis's thought voice, cutting through the memory. You may proceed.
Ahriman's gunship shot on towards the comet. With it came flights of others, trailing out behind it like the wings of a great bird. The word-bearers fell into place amongst them. The wings of their craft gleamed a deeper crimson in the sunlight. Lines of script covered them from nose to tail, each word an exaltation of the powers of the warp. The minds of the warriors in each craft hissed and echoed with prayers. For them, this was not just an act of occult war. It was a sacred devotion. Ahriman felt a wave of revulsion and pulled his senses away from them. The surface of the comet loomed before them. Plugs of plasteel and raw iron covered old wounds from boarding torpedoes and weapons fire. These were the scars from when the Imperial fists had purged the shrine in the early years of the war. The whole comet had been hollowed out 2 centuries before and become a resting place for the bones of the greatest heroes from the War of Unification and the Great Crusade. The skull of Scand, first of the Thunderlords to fall in battle, had been laid here beside that of Maxilla, Barcaria Vu, and thousands more. It had been a shrine to unity and heroism, and the word-bearers had guarded its halls since the time before they had borne that name. They were still there when their treachery had been revealed, and so Rogel Dorn had sent his sons to slay them. They had done that. But, with the limited insight typical of the Seventh Legion, they had not thought to ask a deeper question. Why had the word-bearers remained at all? Rockets loosed from the wings of the gunships. Fire erupted across the sealed breaches in the comet's skin. Shreds of metal and stone erupted into the vacuum. The gunships slid through the reopened wounds into the comet's interior. Ahriman was on his feet before the gunship settled. His brothers followed, turning in perfect time as they moved to match him. Air misted into the cold dark as the hatch released. The space beyond was silent and still. Sunlight shone in through the holes to the void. Soot and scorch marks covered the visible floor and walls. Dry, broken bones lay at the base of walls of skulls. Ahriman's eyes picked out names and deeds carved across the foreheads of each. Thousands of empty eye sockets returned his gaze. He let out a breath inside his helm. It tasted of dust. He felt the ghosts of myriad wars whisper and rattle at the edge of his senses. Voices of ancient battles clung to the teeth of the skulls. The blood spilt by the word-bearers before their purging filled his mouth with the taste of copper and iron. Around him, the rest of the thousand suns spread out in rings, their eyes turned out and their thoughts turning in harmony. Beyond them, the hatches on 3 word-bearers' gunships opened. Bones and parchment covered the warriors that emerged. Half of them led thin humans in white robes. Unsuited, the mortals began to choke as they staggered down the ramp and knelt. The word-bearers cut their throats before their hearts stopped. The prayers in each of the humans' minds became a shriek as their death thrust the words deep into the ether. Blood splashed the scorched floor. A last figure walked from the gunship, arms raised in blessing, black and red armour gleaming with the crude runes of the greater aspects of the warp. A helm of brushed bronze enclosed his head, eyeless and mouthless. Books hung from his waist on chains, and his hand held a sceptre of black iron, topped by a rough stone star. A thin human in a skin-tight black pressure suit walked 1 step behind its master. Its eyes were lidless and pinned open behind fluid-filled goggles. A vox amplifier filled the space where its mouth would have been. It was the voice slave of its master, bound by crude telepathy to the warrior that it followed like a shadow. That master had no name. He was just the apostle of the unspeaking. The lack of a name would have struck Ahriman as typically ridiculous, if it had not been for the fact that the apostle's mind was both shadowed and elusive, his thoughts and emotions dissolving from sight as soon as Ahriman's senses turned towards them. That, and the fact that he had never heard of this warrior before, made him wonder. Much had changed in the years of the Thousand Suns' exile, and even before then, there were millions of legionaries divided between legions spread across the galaxy. But there was something about the blankness of this apostle that made Ahriman wonder what soul moved beneath the bronze mask. The apostle bent down, dipped his fingers in the blood of one of the sacrifices, and scattered it into the void. A single jagged word echoed from the apostle's mind. Around him, all the word-bearers knelt. Ahriman felt the psychic resonance in the shrine altar, unbalancing for a moment. He held his will steady, felt the patterns in his thoughts compensate. "Do not do that again," he sent, edging the sending with flat command. The apostle turned his blank helm towards Ahriman.
"This is a sacred thing," rasped the voice slave's vox. "It must be marked. The rites and offerings must be observed."
"Do nothing that I do not command. I will not see your ignorance undo this work."
"We do the work of the gods here, sorcerer. It was us that seeded the ground for this act long before you even saw your place in the universe. Do not think that this is a matter of knowledge and power. The gods laugh at such arrogance, but bless those who submit to them."
Ahriman felt anger spark within him, and cut it away with a flick of will. He drew a breath, and his humours balanced again. He turned from the word-bearers as Ignis approached from where his gunship had settled behind the rest. The Master of Ruin's Terminator armour was the orange of furnace flame, and threaded with lines that echoed the tattoos that marked his face. His remade automaton walked behind him, its weapon mounts tracking the word-bearers as they moved through the chamber.
"Faith and ignorance are so often alloyed that they might as well be called one," said Ignis.
"An observation we can agree on," replied Ahriman.
"It is not an observation. It is an objective truth."
Ahriman watched as the word-bearers moved across the chamber. Occasionally, one of them would stop, and Ahriman would hear the thought echo of a canticle spilled into the ether.
"The artificial gravity is stable," he sent to Ignis, still watching the apostle and the other word-bearers.
"It is. The primary systems of this facility were maintained to an adequate level. Power, gravity, atmosphere. It's all functioning."
Ahriman nodded. In the churn and swirl of the ether, he felt something shift, something that cast a shadow across his thoughts and tugged at their patterns. For a second, he felt as though he had just stepped off the edge of a hidden precipice. He steadied himself, turning his will and sight inwards until the sensation of falling passed.
"Breach the walls and bring them in."
Ignis gave a small nod. Ahriman felt a pulse of thought pass out through the shrine walls to where the ships waited. A second later, a patch of the vaulted ceiling above began to glow with heat. Then it blew outwards. A new glowing hole over 100 meters wide opened to reveal the sunlight and the hull of the Ankh Tauwai. Tugs and haulers swarmed forwards as more fresh holes appeared in the comet's skin. Black, slab-shaped containers the size of battle tanks slid through the openings. Spider-limbed servitors detached from the tugs and began to unfasten the containers. Ahriman could feel the growling ache of psychic noise from within as the first layers of sedation faded from their cargo. The tugs pulled back until the solitarium hung in the void between the ship and the comet. Silver and plasteel sheathed the solitarium sphere. Rune-stamped chains had been welded to the casing, and 5 tugs had dragged it from the guts of the Ankh Tauwai and into the vacuum. Worms of light played up and down the chains. It creaked and shivered as it moved, its dimensions seeming to flick between being close and far off, even as you looked at it. Ahriman held his mind in a state of perfect balance, as the sealed sphere was lowered through the hole like an eye being set back into its socket. The chains holding the solitarium broke before they were unfastened, their substance dissolving to light and smoke. It hung a meter above the floor of the chamber. Sparks of multicoloured light earthed into the void. Two of the word-bearers were on their knees, tongueless mouths filling with blood as they thanked their gods. Ahriman felt the storm winds rising in the realm beyond. He gave a single nod.
We begin.
Battle barge Monarch of Fire, Jovian Gulf. The iron blood gathered speed as it cut towards the glimmer of Jupiter. Beside it and around it, the main force of its daughters and cousins rode in formation. Together they formed a cylinder, thousands of kilometres long, stretching behind the flagship like the shaft of an arrow. Its path was direct, a line cut through the Jovian Gulf to cross the space between Uranus and Jupiter in the shortest time. It would pass through the orbit of Saturn, but the ringed planet was on the other side of the solar disk. It was predictable to the defenders, but it was also swift, and Perturabo and his legion had greater need of speed than they did subtlety. The timetable of war would bear nothing else. Watching from above the path of the Iron Warrior's fleet, Halbrecht found little comfort in what he saw. In the cold light of tactical displays, there was one question that he found his mind returning to again and again. This force was behaving as Dorn and his senior commanders had predicted. The traitors were bloodied and had suffered great losses in taking Uranus. They had lost days, and they would lose more strength and time as they made this passage. Even now the mines and deadfall munitions strung along their route would be activating. The first ultra-long-range Nova cannon shots from Halbrecht's fleet were zeroed and ready for his command. They would accelerate down to intersect with the Iron Warrior's predicted path. Once they had accelerated to maximum velocity, they would cut loose their rocket boosters and fall down towards their detonation points. Almost undetectable, they would strike amongst the enemy like arrows shot by an unseen archer. Then, Halbrecht's ships would follow their path and engage the Iron Warriors as they advanced, forcing them to turn and fight or press on and die. But that would not stop the Fourth Legion. That bitter fact lingered in Halbrecht's thoughts.
"Loose,"
he said, without looking up from the displays. The Nova cannons began to fire. He waited, feeling the silence ache under the dome of the Monarch of Fire's bridge. He waited and watched. The fleet with him would have been enough to break a Star Kingdom. Hundreds of warships from the remains of the Imperial Fist's fleet, augmented by ships of the Blood Angels, and more from the fleets of Saturn and Jupiter. Most had been held back from the battle around Uranus, floating silently in the interplanetary gulf, waiting for this battle. But it still would only be enough to wound, not to kill, not to make an end. Halbrecht looked up. The eyes of his command crew gazed down at him from the stacked tiers of platforms circling the command dais.
"Forwards,"
he said. And the second sphere fleet lit its engines and plunged down towards the traitors. The Iron Warriors saw them when they were still distant. They began to run calculations, estimating strength and risk. They did not slow or break formation. They could not. They did not have time to spare. The first of the Nova shells reached its detonation zone and exploded. The blast wave stripped void shields from five warships. Another struck, and another, and another, until the Iron Warrior's fleet was strobing with fire. The Monarch of Fire was the first ship to engage as it entered range. Plasma poured from it. Three ships vanished in curtains of light. The fleet behind it split, lancing into the Iron Warriors. Macro shells flew from batteries to meet them, and the night vanished in the flash of explosions. Outer Solar System. Terror grew at the edge of the light of the sun. On Neptune's moon lay a meteor, the quiet followers of a sect called the Paths of Revelation, pumped calmer gas into the habitats sunk into the satellite's skin. The paths of revelation had grown from old seeds planted in old night. Leomedia was not a kind home. Fuel reservoirs and processing plants ate its people. The wars between Xenos, pirates, and empire builders had seen it change hands many times. Its population had been slaves and citizens, and the meat fed into the machine of its industries. The unity of the Imperium had changed some of that, but not all. And in the uncertainty of that life, the paths of revelation had found generations of followers. They were patient, waiting for their time to come, knowing that one day the spirits of truth would come, and both they and all those that had preceded them would ascend as one to a realm without want or hunger or limit of delight. And now that time had come. They had heard the call crooned into their ears as they slept. So after they sent the habitats to sleep, they overrode the maglocks of every fourth hab unit. They went between the unlocked doors, clothed in tattered rags bleached white or stained red. They took something from those who slept inside each door they opened, a trinket, a hand, a face. And when Leomedia woke again, it woke screaming. In the warp, the tides of delight and spite heard the screams and sang in chorus. On Saturn, the dead came as terror's heralds. Night lords had taken civilian ships fleeing Uranus. There were bulk haulers and shuttle transports, packed with people fleeing towards the hoped-for safety of Saturn or the interplanetary gulfs. They found no safety or mercy. Their holds bearing the dead and dying, their helms and engines locked on course, the ships drove at Saturn. The first warnings and hails from the planet's defences triggered vox recordings in each ship. Wails, screams and pleas filled the ears of the defenders as they fired and tore the first slaughter ship from the void. More and more ships of the dead came to burn on the edge of the great planet's rings. Blood poured into the void and froze. Screams vanished into the vacuum. And just out of weapons range, the ships of the Eighth Legion circled, watched, and laughed. In the light of the guns, and in the sound of last pleas for mercy, thirsting things drank. On the Grylor city station, death came from within. The size of a hive city, the station had grown from old ships moored next to each other that had been bound by bridges and growths of welded metal. Tethered to an asteroid on a slow orbit of the sun, it was a layover for ships plying the outer system trade routes. But no ships had come for weeks. No signals from the throne world. No news or warnings. Just the flashes of distant lights and the dreams of red rivers flowing between forests of pale trees without leaves. On and on the quiet went. The blight began with food. Starch paste grew green and yellow blooms. Tanks of nutrient base soured to black sludge. Bit by bit, Grylor's food stores went bad. Some ate it anyway. They died screaming, voiding fluids, blood clogging their eyes. The water was next. Salts formed in reservoir tanks and pipes. Those that drank it wasted to nothing, unable to weep from thirst. After 4 days, the whole of the city station was deserted. Its atmosphere systems circulated air through corridors and rooms, peopled only by corpses covered in forests of mould and pale fungus. In the light of fizzing lumens, rotting things pupated and swelled as they breathed in the silence. Strike Frigate Persephone, Inner System Gulf. Sigismund saw the dead ship fall back. Silence hung over the Persephone, as the image of the vessel receded until it was marked only by the blink of a rune on the tactical display.
"More names to mark on the walls of the fallen," said Ran,
a growl edging his low voice.
"The traitors will pay, my brother. We will ensure it."
Sigismund did not reply, but watched the marker rune until the sensors lost hold of the dead ship's signal. It had been the Sunchild, a young ship set to the void in the year before the war had begun. Now it would drift as a tomb. Maybe one day its hull would be reclaimed by the victor of this last battle. But if not, it would drift on the solar tides, cold and dark, until the sun claimed it, or its iron corpse became a cloud of debris. They had been losing ships day by day and hour by hour. It was as though the solar system were claiming a blood price for every step they took towards Terra. Battle damage had claimed some early on. Others had succumbed to their wounds over time. They had scuttled some, taking what crew and supplies they could and sending the ships to death pyres that lit the gulf of night. Others, like the Sunchild, they had simply had to let fall back as their damaged reactors failed. There was no choice, and all of the surviving fleet knew it. They could see the battle light glimmer around Mars, and hear the broken signals from Uranus and Saturn. The jaws of the enemy were biting deep. There were enemies loose in the gulf between the worlds, too. Wild fleets and carrion feeder ships looking for easy prey. Some had tried to slow Sigismund's force. All who had tried had died. "We're entering the inner system," came the voice of one of the command crew. Sigismund could hear the exhaustion and the control in the officer's voice.
"My lords, what is our course?"
Sigismund did not need to look at the display to know the position. There were fleets down around Mars and swarming from the outer system to the inner. A large force was bearing down on Terra and Luna from above the orbital disk. It was not a choice of where they could make a difference. He had brought fewer than 100 ships to this point. All were damaged and under strength in contingent and crew. The battles they were riding towards would be the clash of thousands of forces, as great as or greater than those they had faced at Pluto. The choice was simply where they would stand in this next passage of war, and where their blood would fall.
"On the ground of the world that bore me, at the heart of the Imperium that made me," said Sigismund,
hearing the words come to his lips in answer to the thoughts turning in his head. He looked at Ran, and the scarred warrior, who smiled through victory and death just the same, gave a grim nod.
"I will stand there, at my father's side."
"And I will stand there with you," said Ran.
"Terra," said Sigismund, feeling the tug of old prophecy at the edge of his thoughts.
"Hold course for Terra."